everybody. Let's continue with the Kuzari on page 71. Let's get our bearings here. The rabbi has just finished explaining to the Khazar king that the basis of our faith is not an intellectual conclusion that there's a God who's the creator of heaven and earth, but rather that we have a first-hand account of an experience that the Jewish people had thousands of years ago at Har Sinai. And based on that first-hand experience, we remain faithful to that tradition that God gave to us. So this is a very important sort of central foundational theme within the Kuzari, that the basis of our faith is not an intellectual understanding of God and that there must be a creator, but that the foundation of our faith is the experience that we as a people had collectively at Har Sinai, and that God gave us the Torah, and that he gave us commandments, and that there is a very, what we would call, a particularist attitude that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi takes to Judaism, that it was given exclusively to the Jewish people at Har Sinai, to the exclusion of all other peoples. And that in itself is the basis of why we believe in God, because of the very particular and unique exposure that we as a people had that no one else ever had of God. This is very startling, very astonishing to the Khazar king, because he has never before heard in this narrative, he has never before heard of a religion that is particularist, that is unique to one segment of the population. His conception of religion in general, when doing sort of a review of the world religions of his time, is that every single religion is, the objective of every single religion is to expose the entire world to that faith and to initiate the entire world to a certain universal way of thinking. And many times, not just a universal way of thinking, but also a universal practice, that we want the whole world to become Christian. We want the whole world to become Muslim. We want the whole world to become philosophers. And for the first time, he is hearing a cleric of a particular religion saying that we're not interested in the whole world becoming Jewish. Judaism was very intentionally given to one nation at a face-to-face revelation where the rest of the world was away, was the rest of the world was excluded from that experience. And that's novel. That's unusual. And that's what is going to cause the Khazar king to say, what's going on? And that's where we're up to over here. And this begins, this section, paragraph 26 in the Kuzari on page 71, really begins the most controversial presentation that you'll find in all of Sefer HaKuzari, the elite nature of the Jewish people. How the Jewish people, because of the fact that God chose us and gave his Torah exclusively to the Jewish people, are superior in some way to the rest of humanity. So, that's what we're going to embark on. You've been warned. You've been warned that this is where we're going, and that we're going to be on thin ice, and that you may squirm a little bit in your seat when you read what Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi has to say. Now, some of you may say, well, this is, of course, this is what I've always believed. And some of you may feel very comfortable with the notion that the Jewish people are superior to everyone else. And some of you may feel very uncomfortable with it, and I'd like to have that discussion with you. But let's get into some text today. We need a reader. Someone's going to read nice and loud and proud. Go ahead, Sifra.
The Kuzari said, if this is so, it would seem that your Torah was given only to you Jews and no one else was bound by it. The rabbi said, you are right, but now non-Jews who wish to adhere to the Torah will share in the rewards like us, though not to the same degree. If the requirement to follow the Torah were based on the fact that God created us, then all people, white and black alike, would be obliged to follow it. Rather, we Jews are obliged to follow the Torah because God took us out of Egypt and attached his glory to us. God did this specifically for us, as we are the choicest of all mankind.
So just notice what he said at the beginning of paragraph 27, that non-Jews who wish to adhere to this regimen are perfectly well, they can adhere to the Torah, they'll share rewards with us, just not to the same degree. Now, is he referring to converts in this paragraph, do you think? What is he referring to?
Non-Jews
who don't convert to Judaism, who want to put on tzitzis, right? Or want to daven, or want to shake a lulav, or want to observe Shabbos. Okay, this in itself, by the way, was a shiur that I gave a few weeks ago on Monday night. The question being, is it okay for a non-Jew to observe any mitzvah that he or she wants to? Is it okay for a non-Jew to observe Shabbos, for example? Well, the Gemara says quite explicitly, Goy Shashavas Chayiv Misa, that if a Gentile observes Shabbos in its entirety, they're liable for the death penalty. Did you know that? When a person is studying for conversion and then they're in the process of going through their conversion process, the rabbis of the Beis Din tell them, we want you to get into the habit of observing mitzvot, but you can't be totally Shomer Shabbos. You have to do one thing to violate Shabbos, because Shabbos is considered to be a unique, almost a marital relationship between God and the Jewish people. It's Oti, Beinu Bein Bnei Yisrael. It's a special, exclusive relationship between God and Israel. And if a person were to violate it by trying to sort of trespass on Shabbos observance and not be part of the Jewish people, it's almost like interfering into a sacred relationship, like a marriage between God and Israel. So there's a famous story about a guy who's learning with his chavrusa. They've been learning Gemara for 20 years. And the fellow says across the table, he says, you know, Yankel, I have a confession to make. He says, what is it, Mark? He says, I have to tell you something. I'm really not Jewish. He says, what are you talking about? You're not Jewish. We went to yeshiva together. I know, my mother never converted. So I don't understand. So then why are you so interested in all of this stuff? He says, I just love learning Torah. He said, but I don't understand. Goy Shashavas Chayiv Misa, how could you be Shomer Shabbos and live in the community with us? He says, oh, it's okay, because every Shabbos, I keep a key in my pocket and I walk outside. So he says, but we have an Eruv. He says, I don't hold a vet Eruv. Anyway, so that's the old joke. Okay. Anyway, so this halacha applies to most mitzvot. Another area where we would not allow a non-Jew to participate in a mitzvah is if he wanted to wear tefillin. Because when it comes to things that are known as tashmishei kedusha, artifacts of mitzvahs that have an inherent kedusha because they have God's name attached to them, so we also there we wouldn't allow a non-Jew to put on tefillin. But for the majority of mitzvahs, if a non-Jew wants to, gezun to hate. We have a principle that anyone who wants to do a mitzvah, even if they're not obligated to, is allowed to partake in a mitzvah. This is especially relevant to most of the people in this room. Even if you're exempt from a mitzvah, you still get rewarded even if you're not obligated to. For example, women are exempt from the mitzvah of yeshivat sukkah. You're exempt from living in a sukkah during the festival of Sukkot. And yet if you do it, you get a mitzvah. You can even make a bracha on sitting in a sukkah, even though you're exempt from that mitzvah, because it's a mitzvah aseh shehazman grama, that it's a positive commandment that's time-bound. Yes? And so therefore, now obviously there are clearly, we're not drawing a parallel between non-Jews and women. But the only parallel that we're drawing is that the scope of commandments differs from different demographics. Jewish males have 613 commandments potentially, or they have certainly more commandments. They have the largest amount of commandments. Jewish females have a smaller subset of those commandments. Gentiles have Noahide commandments, And they too, if they want to, can observe mitzvot that they are exempt from performing, because they're exempt from all of the 613 commandments that were given to the Jewish people. But if they want to, they can do them, most of them, as I mentioned, and they receive reward, just not to the same degree. And this is based on the principle that the Gemara also says, Gadol ha-mitzuveh ve'oseh, mimi she'eino mitzuveh ve'oseh. Greater is a person who is commanded to do the mitzvah and does it, than a person who is exempt from doing the mitzvah and does it. Now that, in one sense, seems counterintuitive. As a matter of fact, there's a great rabbi in the Gemara who was blind. And he said that originally I thought that because I'm blind, if I participate in certain mitzvahs that blind people are exempt from, I would get even a greater reward. Because here I am, dedicating my life to doing mitzvahs that I don't really have to do. Doesn't that make me into a greater person? He says, no, but then I heard the halacha that if you're commanded to do the mitzvah and you do it, then you get even more reward for that mitzvah than if you're not commanded to do the mitzvah and you do it. Now, isn't that counterintuitive? Wouldn't you think just the other way, that if a person volunteers to do a mitzvah, when they don't have to, they should get a greater reward? It's one thing to have to do it and I do it. Okay, so I did it because I had to. But what if I don't have to do it and I do it? Shouldn't I get an even greater reward? So why is this principle true? Why is it that when a person is patur, when a person is exempt, then the reward that is waiting for that person is not as great as the reward for a person who's obligated to do the mitzvah? Anyone want to suggest a reason?
Yeah. When you're obligated, it's more important for you to do it. So that's the reward. You should be doing it.
Well, so what you're suggesting is the very fact that God obligates me to do the mitzvah means that there's something within me metaphysically, like what you can call it, my neshama, or something like that, that needs this tikkun, that needs this kind of rectification from the mitzvah that I'm doing. And so therefore, right, there's more within me that needs to be rectified, and that in itself is the gratification of rectification, right? That the fact that I'm able to rectify myself is in itself the reward. Yes?
Harder to do something if you have to than if you want to.
That's the other famous answer. Very good. And it's harder to do something if you have to, because there's a natural yetzer hara. We see this with our kids. Right? Eat your vegetables. No! Right? I'm not going to eat my vegetables. Right? Because I know I have to. Right? Then if it becomes an option, so there's less of the yetzer hara to do it. So there are a number of explanations as to why this is true. We've offered a couple. But the point is that if a non-Jew wishes to observe mitzvot, we should never deny a non-Jew an entree. If they like to do a mitzvah, they can, with the exception of Shabbos and Tefillin and perhaps a couple of others. Which is why, if a non-Jew wants to come to shul to daven on Shabbos morning, we'll give him a sitter. There's nothing wrong with a non-Jew coming to synagogue to pray, especially when it comes to prayer, because there it's quite explicit. Ki beiti beit tefilah yikare l'chol ha'amim, the prophet says, my house is a house of prayer for all the nations. Right? And therefore, even the Beis HaMikdash was open for sacrificial service of non-Jews. A goy was allowed to bring a korban to the Beis HaMikdash. They did it by proxy, but God wants to create accessible points of accessibility to him for the entire world. But the accessibility of that the Jewish people have through the Torah is, of course, the widest accessibility. God has a certain expectation of a very strong connection between the Jewish people and HaKadosh Baruch Hu that he does not expect of the rest of the world. It's accessible. They would like it. They can either fulfill mitzvahs that they're commanded to fulfill, the seven Noahai laws, or they can fulfill more mitzvahs even that they're not commanded to fulfill. And obviously, conversion is always an option. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu does make these things available to the rest of the world. Now, conversion for Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is going to be a very important issue. And we're going to get to that soon. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. So the thing that's quite provocative about the end of this paragraph is, God did this specifically for us. He obliged us to follow the Torah. He took us out of Egypt and attached his glory to us. Because why? Because we are the choicest of all mankind. We are the segula, which is really a term from the Torah. This is really what we're reading about as we get ready for Shavuos, that God presents the Torah to the Jewish people in Parshas Yisro. And he says, You will be to me the choicest of all mankind. You shall be to me, what's the word, another word for segula, like a treasure. You'll be to me special. You're the most special of all mankind from all the other nations. Provocative indeed. So let's continue reading. Paragraph 28, page 72.
The Kuzari said, "Careful, Jew, you are regressing. Your speech has gone lean after having been rich." The rabbi responded, "Lean or rich, please just keep an open mind until I have explained myself." The Kuzari said, "Say what you wish." The rabbi said, "Regarding organic behavior, we find that creatures require nourishment. They grow, reproduce their own kind, and each type of creature has its own necessary qualities and conditions. This is true about the plant and animal kingdoms, to the exclusion of non-living things in nature, such as earth, stone, metals, and pure elements." The Kuzari said, "An oversimplification, but nevertheless true."
Okay, let's hold it just here for a second. What the rabbi is about to embark on is a very simplistic explanation of the natural order of all that exists in the physical world. And essentially what you're going to see him laying out over here is that there are different, when I was growing up, we had the kingdom, phyla, class, right? King plays chess on 40 green spaces. That's how I remembered it, right? And when I was taking biology. In other words, you have all of these different classifications of different genus and species and different levels and orders of creation. From Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's perspective, there's not equality. You can't say that a rock is equal to an insect, which is equal to a plant. There's different levels of complexity and different levels of importance. There's a food chain, right? There's animals that are stronger, there are animals that are more intelligent, there are creatures that are not even animals, there's plant life, and there's an inorganic existence that is here on this planet. And obviously, when God created all of these things, it wasn't important for God to create equality. It was important for God to create diversity and variety within the world. And equality was not a part of his to-do list. That was never the mandate that God had for this world, that everything should be on an equal playing field. Because if that were the case, then everything would just be the same. The world would be comprised of, I don't know, green blobs that would just be floating around, you know, we would all be the same. There wouldn't be plant life, there wouldn't be inorganic minerals, there wouldn't be humans, there wouldn't be animals, everything would just be the same. And that's just not the way God had it planned out. Continue.
The rabbi said, "And regarding animal behavior, all animals share the same life force, which provides them with mobility, natural instincts, traits, senses, the ability to process information, desires, and the like." The Kuzari said, "This is also well known and irrefutable."
So what he's done up until now, he's classified three different orders of creation. The lowest order is inorganic material, such as minerals, metals, diamonds, things like that, stone. Then the next level up is organic material, organic life, plants, trees, flowers, grass. The third level are animated creatures, which are the animal kingdom, or basically anything that moves and has life. That's the third level. I mean, obviously, this is a very simplified way of looking at it. There are many different ways of breaking down the different orders of creation, but so far we've seen three different levels. And now, what's the next level up? Where are we going? Humanity. Okay, let's go. Continue.
The rabbi continued, "And regarding intelligent behavior, the human being is distinguished from all other animals. Man's higher intellect requires of him more refined behavior. The establishment of civilization, the exercising of social justice, and other forms of conduct and etiquette."
Okay, now this, of course, is taking into account that the human being was granted or imbued with an intellect for a specific purpose. And that bears, that assumes that there's a God who deliberately created things the way that he did. When God created animals, he created them purely with instinct and did not create them with a sense of conscience and a sense of morality, a sense of right and wrong. But because God gave intelligence and conscience to human beings, this gift demands of humanity that we set up social systems where morality is part of our social construct and where justice is allotted to all members of humanity, of civilization. So that's the reason why human beings are set aside or differentiated from animals. It's because, and we're not even talking on a religious level here. We're speaking on an, I guess, on an anthropological level. Just, you know, looking at it from the way that the world is structured, the thing that divides humanity from animals is intelligence, is the ability to think. Okay, so let's continue.
The rabbi asked, "And what level do you think ranks above the human?" The Kuzari said, "The level of the great wise man." The rabbi said, "I only wish to classify levels between things which are fundamentally different, such as inorganic matter versus plant life and human beings versus animals. But to classify within the same type by drawing distinctions between those with more and those with less is unproductive. Those types of classifications do not examine traits which fundamentally define the level, and so cannot be considered true distinctions."
And this is an important philosophical sort of classification, that you have things that have certain essential or innate differences, and other things which have sort of more of or less of. To say that there are distinctions between human beings because some human beings have more intellect and some human beings have less intellect, and that was the Khazar King's attempt. He was trying to say that there's, you know, maybe you could divide among different levels of humanity. Some people have sort of just a modicum of intellect, with just enough to be able to allow them to structure society properly, and other human beings have a much higher level of intellect, which allows them to sort of comprehend the purpose of being and all of reality and so forth. He says, no, that's not a good distinction, because after all, the thing that makes us unique from animals is that we all share one thing in common. We call that intellect. Animals only have instinct, they don't have intellect. So don't make divisions that are unnecessary or unproductive. That's, you know, to say some people have more intellect, some people have less intellect, that's not going to do it for me, he says. Okay? So therefore, if you're searching for a fifth level, so we've got the lowest level is inorganic, then we've got second level plant life, third level animal life, fourth level human life. So what ranks above the human? What could possibly rank above the human being? What does he say? Go ahead, please.
The Kuzari said, "If so, then there is no physical creature on a higher level than the human being."
Doesn't seem to be to exist, right?
The rabbi said, "But let us say we could find a Superman who could walk through fire unscathed, who could go without food and not starve, who could radiate from his face such a bright aura that an eye could not look directly at it, and who would never become ill or weak. And when this Superman will have accomplished his purpose in life, he would die of his own accord at a set time, like someone who lies down on his bed and goes to sleep. And right before his death, this person would know everything that happened in the past and all that will transpire in the future. Would you not agree that this person occupies a separate level from the rest of mankind?"
Who are we referring to?
Moshe
Rabbeinu. Isn't it? This is a description of Moshe Rabbeinu. Let's go through all of the different descriptions. He could walk through fire unscathed. When, think about what happened at Matan Torah, at the giving of the Torah. What happened? There was a great fire atop of Har Sinai, and Moshe ascends and walks into the great darkness of the cloud, of the smoke, in the midst of the fire. So that's one thing, okay. Could go without food and not starve. He's up in the Har Sinai 40 days and 40 nights, and is able to have some kind of transcendent out-of-body experience that allows his body to survive without food and water, who could radiate from his face such a bright aura that an eye could not look directly at it. What is this referring to? The karnei or, like the beams of, or the rays of light that shone off of Moshe's face when he brought down the second pair of luchot as recorded in Parshas Ki Tisa. Right? It says that the people couldn't look, and what did Moshe have to do? He had to place a veil over his face because the radiance from his face was too bright for people to gaze upon. Who would never become ill or weak? What is that a reference to? How do we know that Moshe never became ill or weak? It says in Vezos Abracha, at the very end of the Torah, Lo Nas Lecho, that he lo chaha eino v'lo nas lecho, that his eyes never became dim. Right, what a gift that would be, right? Time for me to get a new prescription. V'lo nas lecho, and the moisture of his body never left him. In other words, he was vibrant and vigorous and healthy till he was 120, to his very last breathing, to his very last breath. He was strong and robust, right? And when he accomplished his life purpose, what happened? He died of his own accord at a set time, like someone who lies down on his bed and goes to sleep. Well, HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes Moshe Rabbeinu and takes him up to Har Nevo and shows him the land of Israel, and then gives him his final burial spot, and gives him what's called mitat nishika, and gives him the kiss, the divine kiss, that just very, very gently and peacefully removes the soul from the body. And right before his death, this person would know everything that happened in the past and all that would transpire in the future. So this too, God shows Moshe Rabbeinu all of Eretz Yisrael, but it's not just that he shows Moshe Rabbeinu Eretz Yisrael, just a panoramic view of the land. According to Chazal, he showed Moshe Rabbeinu the entire chronicle of history from the time of creation to the present, and all that would transpire for the Jewish people from that time until the Messianic age. As a matter of fact, the Gemara even has a story about how Moshe Rabbeinu was, as he was being shown the unfolding of Jewish history, was brought to a shir where Rabbi Akiva was teaching Torah. And Moshe Rabbeinu became very disheartened because he couldn't understand the shir. He just became very, very upset, until Rabbi Akiva said, everything that I told you now is halacha l'Moshe Misina, is a Mosaic tradition going back to Moshe Rabbeinu. So Moshe Rabbeinu then was consoled, because he understood that every generation has a different way of expressing ideas, but they all originally come and they emanate from the Torah that Moshe Rabbeinu gave to us. Yes? So this was Moshe's exposure to the unfolding of all of history. So what an amazing experience that Moshe has. And would you not agree that this person occupies a separate level from the rest of mankind? Now, here's something quite fascinating. Was Moshe unique? If Moshe Rabbeinu is unique, then is it fair for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi to say that there's another sort of class of creature that exists in this world that is above the human being? If there was only one Moshe Rabbeinu, then is it really a legitimate argument to make that there is something called a Superman that occupies a class above the rest of humanity? No, if this was just one human being that existed, he might have existed, as some commentaries say, that God created a Moshe Rabbeinu for the singular, unique purpose of delivering the Torah to mankind, to the Jewish people. And like the Torah itself testifies, there never was a prophet before Moshe that rivaled him, nor would there ever be a prophet of his level that would come after him. So what is Rabbi Yehuda Halevi trying to point out from this example that he's giving of Moshe? This is something that's very important to think about, because we really have to understand that what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is describing is not just one Moshe Rabbeinu, he's describing an entire core of people who have existed within the Jewish people at different times in our history. So he's describing what? What is he describing? What's that?
Like a Gadol HaDor.
He's describing a tzaddik. I think it's more than just a tzaddik, because I don't know if a tzaddik would rise to this level, but certainly we'd like to consider our gedolim and our tzaddikim to be on this kind of level. What's that? Prophets. He's on the level of a navi. It's on the level of a navi. For Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, the prophetic class is one class of human beings. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that all neviim are of the same level of prophecy, but they at least have the potential to come into the same category as Moshe Rabbeinu. Remember, he said you can't divide with the mores and the lesses to say that those are two different groups, just like you can't say that philosophers are in a different category from the rest of humanity. There must be something inherently different about prophets. Their soul occupies a different level of specialness than the rest of humanity. Yeah.
But Bilam will throw, it's with the problem, Bilam was prophetic experience.
Who says the Bilam is not part of this?
He's not Jewish.
Where do you see that you have to be Jewish in order to occupy this level?
I'm just concerned with the rabbi who later will...
Oh, so you're foreshadowing for us. You're absolutely right. You have to be absolutely right, but I was hoping to unfold that, you see. What we're going to do is we're going to be unpacking that the only human beings that are capable of reaching this level of superhuman are Jewish people. The Jewish people have the unique ability to occupy this fifth level of existence, and anyone who was not born a Jew will never have that ability, no matter how righteous or how close to God they aspire to. And that's part of the controversy. How we were going to reconcile Bilam? Well, Bilam will have to be something that we'll address later on. It's a fair question. It's a fair question. Okay. So anyway, the Kuzari is a little bit confused because he says in 42, he says, this level is for a divine angelic creature if it at all exists. This behavior belongs in the divine category, not in the human, animal, or organic categories. And the response to that is, well, no, you don't understand that what I've just described to you. This we'll resume next week. What I've just described for you is the greatest of our prophets. And now we're going to tell you how this sort of metagene, if I can use science fiction terminology, how this sort of unique kind of genetic superhuman ability was imparted into one segment of human population to the exclusion of all the rest of it. It's a very eugenic theory. It's got to do with genetics, what family you come from, what your genetics indicate. And when I'm talking about genetics, I'm using a borrowed term, because we're talking about a spiritual genetics. I'm not talking about a physical genetics. It's not something that you can define. There's no Jewish DNA molecule that says, okay, you know, this person has the marker, the genetic marker in their DNA for prophecy. But there is something that is unique, that is passed down from parent to child, that cannot be replicated based upon one's behavior alone. So again, we'll come back to this, Mirtzah Hashem, next week. But bear in mind that this is becoming now sort of somewhat controversial, and we'll pick that up next time.